I'm Heather Goldstone. This is Living Lab on The Point. In the mid-1990s, New England's cod stocks collapsed. One of many consequences was the closure of thousands of square miles of what historically was some of the world's most fertile fishing grounds on Georgia's Bank. 20 years later, cod stocks haven't recovered as quickly as hoped, but the scallop fishery, which was also in bad shape in the mid-90s, has been rebuilt into a leading example of sustainability. The two stories are connected by that closed area and by other themes, as we'll hear this hour. In the second half of the show, Dr. Kevin Stokesbury of UMass Dartmouth will share the story of rebuilding the scallop fishery through cooperative research and the use of novel technologies. But let's start with groundfish. This is New England's most iconic fishery. Cod, haddock, flounder, these days primarily being caught by trawl. But that wasn't always the case. Over the past few hundred years, the cod fishery has gone through multiple technological revolutions, from the introduction of the dory to the highly controversial adoption of the otter trawl last century. These innovations were intended to make fishing more efficient, but critics would say each new technology has just enabled overfishing. With the groundfish industry in crisis, the question is, could technology help? Joining us to help answer that question is Dr. Steve Ayres. He began his career as a fisherman in Australia, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia before moving into research. He's now research scientist at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, where he leads efforts to develop environmentally friendly fishing gear, working together with fishermen and other stakeholders. Steve Ayres, welcome to Living Lab.
Yeah, good morning, Heather. Thanks for that kind introduction, and it's good to be here.
We also want to hear your thoughts. Can technology help overcome the challenges facing New England's fishing industry? Our phone number is 866-999-4626, or you can send us an email to livinglabradio@wgbh.org. You can also find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. So, Steve Ayres, we have a 500-year history of fishing for cod in New England's waters, multiple technological revolutions along the way, each of which history has kind of looked back and simply said, well, really what it did was enable further overfishing of these vulnerable stocks. So my question for you is, can we innovate our way out of our current crisis?
Yeah, I think we can. We've been trying to innovate out of the crisis for a number of years now. And, you know, there's a number of exciting technological innovations out there that will allow trawl fishermen, for example, to reduce fuel consumption by 10% or up to 20%, depending on the modification, to reduce seabed impacts, to fish more selectively, and to target, you know, the species that they want to retain and allow the species they don't want to retain to escape. So, you know, there are some nice things happening, some good research that's happening and some good progress, and it just takes time and effort and finances and resources, but I'm confident we'll get there in the end.
So how much has fishing gear changed in recent years if we just stick to the groundfish industry and these trawlers?
Sure. Well, at the beginning of your show, you spoke about, you know, the introduction of dories and the introduction of trawls about 100 years ago. It's probably fair to say that in the last 100 years, much of the change has been incremental, probably not revolutionary in the true sense of the word. You know, if you took a trawl fisherman from 100 years ago and showed him a trawl net today, he would still recognise the net for what it is. He would recognise the components, and he would know what it's designed to do. I guess what he wouldn't have familiarity with is some of the materials that are used today, some of the synthetic fibres that are used. The design of some of the components has changed a reasonable amount since that fisherman would have been around 100 years ago. But basically, you know, a trawl is a trawl. Its overall design hasn't changed. And so I guess most of what's occurred has been incremental tinkering over the years to get to the trawl system that we have today.
So could you describe what the trawl system is that we have today a little bit for listeners who might not be familiar?
Sure. Well, a trawl system consists of, I guess we think of it as three key parts. There's what's known as trawl doors, and these are steel devices that fishermen use to spread the trawl net open horizontally. Now, a door gets its name from the fact that in the old days, they were made out of timber and they just looked like a door in your house, hence the name door. These days, they're made out of steel. They're often curved in design and have vertical slots. And they're the best analogy is that they're like an underwater aeroplane wing. They're designed to provide lift in the horizontal direction, whereas an aeroplane wing, of course, provides lift in the vertical direction. So there's the trawl doors. They sit on the bottom, they open the trawl net horizontally. Then there are ground cables that extend between the trawl door to the net itself, and they are towed over the surface of the seabed, and much of their function is to herd fish into the path of the trawl net itself. And then we have the trawl net, which is large, which is a large conically shaped net. Meshes tend to vary in size. Generally, it could be 6 inches or more at the fore part of the net at the mouth, and then the net tapers down. The meshes get smaller and smaller, and there's a bag at the end of the net called a cod end. That's the end of the road for the cod or whatever else you're targeting. So the three key components, if you like, are the doors, the ground cables, and the net itself. And all that's connected together. It's then towed over the bottom by the trawler itself.
So you were describing the change that has taken place in the doors from essentially being a slab of wood to being something much more like an airplane wing. Obviously, that's a fairly major shift. Are there certain aspects of this rig, those three different sections that you're talking about, that are more open to innovation and to change, and some others that are more fixed? Are there different aspects of the gear that we can target?
Well, all three of those major components we can target, and currently we're working on those areas now. For example, with the doors, recently we've been looking at a semi-pelagic style of door. So instead of the door being dragged over the top of the seabed, these doors hover slightly above the seabed. Maybe the aft part of the door may contact the seabed intermittently, but the idea is to get the door off the bottom. And when you do that, it allows you to have a more efficiently designed door, which basically means you're generating more lift or spreading force to open the net, and you're generating less drag. And so that means that you can reduce the fuel that's used to tow the gear through the water because you're using a more efficient door. The other benefit, of course, is that because these doors are off the seabed, they're not having any contact or impact with the substrate. So that's just one area where we've been working on. And you know, fishermen are, you know, there's a handful of fishermen that are using these doors. Fishermen are increasingly looking at them. You know, they are an attractive proposition because you can reduce, you know, maybe 10, 12% of your fuel. In fact, we have some fishermen that believe they're saving more than that. The ground cables, as I mentioned earlier, they get dragged over the seabed. And just last week, in fact, we had a trip whereby we were testing the ground cable with large 10-centimetre diameter discs attached every 5 fathoms apart. And the idea was that instead of that entire ground cable being in contact with the bottom, the disc was in contact, and given they're 5 fathoms apart, that meant you substantially reduced the amount of bottom contact. And the idea was to see if we could reduce bottom contact, but also still herd the fish that we wanted into the net, and maybe allow some of the benthic species, those species on the bottom, such as skates and flounders, that we may not want to retain, allow them to swim under the ground gear and escape. And then finally, with the net itself, there's been a fair bit of work in recent years looking at mesh size and mesh geometry, particularly in the cod end where you retain the catch. Traditionally, fishermen used what was known as a diamond mesh cod end, and that's because the orientation of the mesh took on a diamond shape. And more recently, fishermen have been turning those meshes sideways 45 degrees and using the cod end as a square mesh. And the benefit of square mesh is that it remains open all the time. You can imagine a diamond-shaped mesh being flexible material. If you pull on the diamond, you could close the opening of the mesh up. But whereas with a square mesh, the load on the mesh allows it to remain open, so you can allow a lot of small fish to escape. And that's generally a much more selective option. And so fishermen are moving in this direction, and we're increasingly seeing that now.
When you have an idea for a modification to the gear, whether it's the doors or the net, how do you go about testing that?
Yeah, that's a great question, and you know, I guess first and foremost you need to find a partner that's willing to participate in the work. So you need to find a fisherman that wants to be involved, and you know there's no other way to test the gear. You really have to test it on a commercial boat under commercial conditions, if possible. You know, first and foremost, if the fishermen don't like the gear you're testing for one reason or another, then it's not going to be very successful. The acceptance by the fisherman is going to be low. So you really need to be working with a fisherman from the beginning, get his ideas, talk to him about what it is you're trying to do, see if you can get his willingness to participate, and then you need to find funding. And you know, there's a variety of funding sources out there, and most recently The Northeast Fisheries Science Centre Cooperative Research Program has funded a project that we're involved in called GearNet, and this is a multi-stakeholder, very bottom-up approach to conservation engineering research to gear development, whereby we've gone to fishermen up and down the coast from down East Maine all the way down to Rhode Island, asked them what their issues are in terms of fishing gear design. And then we've funded that work and we've found suitable researchers to work with those fishermen. So we've taken a very much bottom-up approach and we're developing gear that they want to see developed.
So I wonder how many of the ideas for gear modifications actually come from the fishermen as opposed to coming from fishery researchers or, you know, someone outside of the industry?
Yeah, I think it depends. It's probably a bit of a balance. You know, fishermen are always thinking about their gear, of course, and are always trying to improve efficiency and improve performance to the best of their capability. But, you know, people like myself, for example, who probably have a more global insight into what's going on, can bring overseas ideas to the table and see whether they mesh up with fishermen's ideas locally, and then see where we go from there. So you really need a blend, I think, of both.
Now, you just mentioned your global perspective, and of course you were a fisherman all over the world before you became a researcher. What drew you to move from being a fisherman to being a researcher that works so much on the fishing gear and innovating the fishing gear?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed my time fishing, and you know, it was an attractive lifestyle to me, spending long periods of time on the water and you know, hunting fish basically, and shrimp, and you know, it was an exciting lifestyle and something that I really enjoyed doing, but I guess then that there came a point where I thought, well, you know, I just wanted something extra, I guess, and wanted to learn more about fishing, and so I went to the Australian Maritime College in Tasmania and did an undergraduate degree in fishing technology. I then fished a little bit more commercially, and I went back there and got a job as a fishing technologist for the last, for near on 20 years before I came here.
So
I was just wanting to do more, I guess, and work more with the industry and probably help them out in that regard rather than being a fisherman myself.
And you've said that the fishermen are often very interested in these gear modifications. Obviously, this is their livelihood. From your perspective now as a researcher, do you find that most fishermen are motivated to make the gear changes, to want to test the new gear and help get these advances into the industry?
I think we have to remember that times are tough for groundfish fishermen at this point in time, of course, and you know, the change in management 4 years ago and the recent reduction in cod and other groundfish has hit the industry pretty hard. And so while there might be a desire to innovate, fishermen often don't have the financial resources to bring about that innovation themselves. And you know, some of the gear that we're talking about, for example, is tens of thousands of dollars, if not more. You know, if we wanted to, for example, put a new engine in a trawler, a more fuel-efficient engine, you know, fishermen could be up for $100,000 or more, depending on the size of boat. And some of the other new innovations out there are equally expensive. So while there might be a desire to innovate, the reality is we're talking a lot of money, and in an uncertain business environment, which fishermen find themselves in at the moment, it can be pretty tough to get them to take on new innovation.
I mean, it's a bit of a catch-22 there, because in a lot of cases you're talking about innovations, whether it's reducing fuel costs by making reducing the drag of the net through the water, or making it actually more efficient or less bycatch. These are all things that, in the end, would benefit fishermen, reduce their bottom line, and make them better able to comply with federal regulations. So how do we support the fishermen in being able to advance these innovations that we need in the long term when we are in such a crisis mode?
Yeah, I think one of the things we probably haven't done as well as we could have, and that's being turned around now, is you know, in the past when we tried to introduce selective fishing gear, for example, that was often accompanied by a loss of commercial catch. And of course, you know, fishermen are going to be concerned for that, and rightly so. More recently, we've begun to really focus on what we call win-win outcomes and look at ways whereby fishermen can benefit and the environment can benefit. And the semi-pelagic door example is an excellent one here, whereby we can reduce fuel consumption by 10% or more for fishermen if they use these doors, and at the same time they reduce seabed impact. Based on the work we've done, there's no difference in commercial catch. So that's really a win-win outcome, and I think we need to focus on those a little bit more.
Win-win definitely sounds like a good idea. I wonder, are there policies or regulatory impediments to getting new technologies into use in the industry?
Well, there is. I mean, you have to have some boundaries with respect to what you can do, but you know, sometimes some of the new ideas do push up against the regulatory framework, and sometimes it takes time to overcome that framework and get the gear introduced. So while it's important to have that framework, you know, we do have to sometimes try to get that change so that a new piece of gear can be introduced that might be more effective. Now, having said that, things like the semi-pelagic doors, for example, there is no regulation pertaining to those, so fishermen could do them and not have to worry about any regulation at this point in time.
So you just have to take it piece by piece, I guess, and figure it out as you come up with the new idea, what would be necessary to actually put it into place.
Correct, yeah.
I wonder if you could pull out your crystal ball and look into the future for us. What kinds of innovations do you think we might see take hold in our groundfish fleet in, say, 10, 20, 50 years? And of course, this is assuming that we do have a groundfish fleet in 10, 20 or 50 years into the future.
Yeah. Well, I hope that the fleet is more profitable than what it is now. You know, there's a lot of people doing it hard, and you know, we hope that that eventually gets turned around, you know, in the next few years, if not sooner. It's, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's pretty tough being a groundfish fisherman at this point in time. One of the interesting things we're seeing is that there's not a lot of young people coming into fishing, and perhaps that's a function of the uncertainty in the industry and just changing times. You know, young people don't necessarily want a life on the water. And so we're seeing an aging fleet, and this is not just in the groundfish industry. This is a national and an international issue, in fact, whereby fishing fleets are getting older and older. I think the average age of fishermen in the US is something like in the late 40s or early 50s. So as time goes by, who's going to take up the space when those guys retire? And what we might see in the future is greater use of foreign crews coming in to pick up where the space where there's just no crews. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or not, but that's something that may actually happen if we don't somehow make fishing more attractive for young people to enter.
I mean, that sounds almost like circling back to 30, 40 years ago, the whole reason that in 1976 Congress passed the Magnuson-Stevens Act was actually to get foreign boats out of U.S. waters, and you're saying at this point we may be needing to import crew actually just to keep the fishery going.
Well, that's right. If we don't find a way to attract young people into the industry, it's going to be increasingly hard to crew those boats. And so something has to give. What do we do? And one obvious choice might be to look for foreign crews. I think the requirement in the US is for captains to be US citizens. So it's not like we're going to get you know, foreign captains coming in the near future anyway, unless that's turned around. But I don't know of an impediment to bringing foreign crews in to crew these boats. And then I think in terms of other innovations down the track, I think we're going to see greater use of some electronics. There's some interesting stuff happening in Europe, for example, whereby they're developing manoeuvrable trawl doors so that fishermen during a tow can lift them higher off the bottom, increase the spreading force or decrease it, you know, manoeuvre them through the water column, which is something we can't do now. And that's quite an exciting development coming our way. Some fishermen and researchers in Norway are playing with underwater camera systems to better select the species they want and remove species they don't want. I'm not sure of its application here, but there's certainly some interesting stuff happening there. And I think basically we'll be much more fuel efficient because, you know, there's increasing interest in fuel conservation, there's increasing interest in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and, you know, we can do that and also save fishermen money. That's a win-win situation, and I think we're going to see that. And I think finally, my vision for the future would be that we focus on what's called energy return on investment, which is, in the fishing sense, the fuel energy that's gone into fishing and the protein energy that comes out. And those two parameters you can turn into a ratio known as energy return on investment. And it's a great way of gauging the efficiency of an operation. And we've not done this before. And interestingly, when you compare trawl caught fish from local fisheries against, for example, industrialized beef or chicken production, fishing stacks up really well. And it's a really nice way to gauge how efficient an industry is. And as I said, fishing looks really good when you start looking at energy return on investment.
Well, maybe some of those new technologies and innovations, we all know the younger generations are very tech savvy, so maybe the two can create a synergy and attract some more young people to our fishing industry. Dr. Steve Ayers heads up efforts to develop environmentally friendly fishing gear at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Steve, thank you.
Thanks very much, Heather. It was a pleasure.
We're talking this hour about technological innovation in New England's groundfish and scallop industries. But not all fishing industries are into innovation. Weir fishing dates back to the Native American residents of Cape Cod. It's a fishing tradition even older than catching cod. Last week, Ernie Eldridge took me out to see one of his weirs just off the beach in Chatham and gave me a quick lesson in how a weir works.
You can't see the whole thing because the tide's high right now, so you can't really see all of the netting. But there's all of these poles down here, there's netting strung all the way down those poles, which go from their tide, you can just see a piece right there. They're tied at the top, and they're leaded at the bottom, so they go all the way to the bottom. And it's large mesh, but it creates a shadow and creates a wall for the fish to kind of swim along.
So it's kind of like a corral.
Essentially, yes. This long piece here, what we call the leader, this is about 500 yards long, and This is kind of like the fence. The fish hit that, and when they encounter something, they tend to want to go to the deeper water, which is where we put this structure out here. We call this area at the very end here, we call it the bowl. This is where the fish ultimately get caught. And this area right here, right just beyond that little bird, those two poles right there, that's what we call the mouth. That's the opening for the fish to get into the weir. This part here, the bowl, as you can see, the net's up here, but it goes all the way across the bottom, too, so that way the fish can't escape. And when we go in to tend it, we go inside the weir, and we start over on one corner. We pick the netting up in front of us, and we all line up on one side of the boat, and we just start pulling the net. And as we pull it, we let the slack netting go underneath the boat, and we just herd the fish over to the other corner, and then we extract them with small dip nets and put them in the boat. And this is usually all like penned off, and we'll put the fish in the pens.
The weir looks like something out of a history or anthropology textbook when you're out there on the water. The poles in particular that anchor the nets really just looked to me like young trees that had been stripped of their bark. They weren't necessarily smooth. They certainly didn't look like they were anything that had been manufactured. So I asked Eldridge about the poles.
I've seen some of the poles last 30 or 40 years. I've seen some of them last 3 or 4 weeks.
Okay.
The beauty of these trees is what you see there, like 6 inches in diameter and 45 feet long, and they're straight as an arrow. Those are 50-year-old trees. They grow very, very slow, which makes them very, very strong. And they're so dense that they don't tend to float when they dry out like other woods. We've used other woods. I've used ash. I've used birch. We've used oak. We've tried different woods, and they work okay the first year, but once they dry out, they're hard to keep them. They tend to want to float up. We can't keep them in the bottom. They're strong, but they just won't stay in the bottom. So we go back to the hickory. It's the proven tree.
Different trees. trying out different species of trees may not be everyone's definition of technological innovation. Of course, as you can hear, Eldridge's boat does have a motor on it. It's a small, about 20-foot boat. And otherwise, he says, there have been very few changes in weir fishing technology, even over hundreds of years.
Yeah, about the only technology is that essentially has changed, maybe is we've gone from cotton netting to nylon netting. That was like big innovative back in the 60s. They switched over to nylon netting, which just lasts so much longer and it's just a much more durable product. But as far as the rest of it, we're still using some of the same stuff that my father did. So it's and he was using the same stuff that the man before him did. So the technology has not changed since its inception around here. They're still built the same way. They're still operated pretty much the same way. So there's really been no change in it. You know, it may make it a little bit easier on us on some of the stuff, how we operate it, but overall the designs of them and everything else is the same as it was 200 years ago.
Even using the same technology as was used 200 years ago, with a few small tweaks here and there, the weir fishing industry is considered very sustainable. The fish that are caught in that net are alive until they're pulled out, which allows the fishermen to select what they want to keep and what they don't, making it essentially a zero bycatch industry. But they are facing some difficulties as a result of climate change, and that's a story that you can hear more about here on WCAI on Wednesday of this week. We now turn to the Atlantic sea scallop fishery. It's among the most valuable in the United States. It accounts for more than $200 million in revenues each year. Three-quarters of New Bedford's earnings come from Atlantic sea scallops. But that hasn't always been the case. In the late 1980s, scallop landings plummeted. They hit bottom a few years later and stayed there until 1999. But harvests have more than doubled since that time. The rebuilding of the scallop fishery is now widely considered a success story of cooperative research and innovation. Dr. Kevin Stokesbury has been intimately involved with that story. He's chair of the Department of Fisheries Oceanography at the School for Marine Science and Technology at UMass Dartmouth. Since 1999, his group has been working with the scallop industry on video surveys of the scallop resource. Kevin Stokesbury, welcome.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. I apologize for the poor phone connection.
Well, we've got you now. So let's say in 1994, when cod stocks collapsed, And for that matter, the scallop industry was hitting bottom. What was going on with the scallop resource at that point?
Well, the resource was quite low. The Georges Bank harvest had been very low, and effort had been shifted down to the Mid-Atlantic, and that was fished very hard, too. And the scallop industry had gone through a number of different kinds of regulations that were very difficult as well, things like the meat count, which really didn't work too well for anyone, and so basically in 1994 things were looking you know there were restrictions on the scallop fishery as well as on the groundfish industry, and they were looking at some cutbacks. And so when they closed the areas, the three large areas on Georges Bank, they closed them to protect groundfish, to protect cod, haddock, and yellowtail. And when they did establish them, they closed them for all mobile fishing gear to protect the habitat as well. And so that cut out some of the very, the traditional scallop grounds. But as I said, most of the effort had shifted to the Mid-Atlantic then. So harvest was pretty low.
Now, you mentioned these areas that were closed to protect groundfish, but those closed areas then ended up kind of incidentally helping the scallop industry and, as I understand it, kind of helped spawn the idea for how the scallop industry is now regulated with rotating closed areas.
Yes. Well, what happened is that, you know, the scallop industry was really hit with a double whammy of regulations. They were under their own rebuilding plan, which restricted the number of days at sea, and it also restricted the number of people you could take on your vessel, and the scallop industry processes its fishery at sea. They shuck the scallops at sea, so they land only the meat. So it's labor intensive at sea. So they restricted the number of people you could take. They increased the ring size, so smaller scallops could escape, and they restricted the number of days at sea. And then on top of that, three of their traditional fishing grounds were closed as well. And so I think, my own opinion is the result of that, and also some good luck that really started to rebuild that resource. So those closed areas, having the vessels out of those closed areas on George's Bank, which were historically extremely productive, allowed the stock to rebound very quickly in there.
Now, it was around 1999 that the stock did start to rebound, and it was around that time that you started working on this problem. And a lot of your research has been aimed at finding new technologies to actually gauge how many scallops are out there, what size they are, what the actual resource would be to support a fishery. And it seems that you've spent a lot of time essentially trying to convince fishery regulators that there are actually more scallops out there than they thought. So what made you think that there were more scallops out there that could be fished?
Well, the short answer is the fishermen told me there are more scallops out there, and I just went and developed a way to verify that. What happened first was there was a cooperative survey between the fishing industry, us at the University of Massachusetts, at it was CMAS at the time, and the National Marine Fisheries Service. And we went out there with six vessels and sampled the southern part of Closed Area 2, which is the furthest closed area east. And we did find large numbers of scallops there. But for management, you need to know the actual number of animals on the seafloor, and then you're allowed to harvest a portion of that. And when you're sampling with dredges, and the traditional way of, in fact, most of the fisheries are still scientifically sampled with either a dredge or a trawl. But that gives you a relative estimate. It's relative only to itself. That's because you don't know the efficiency or the selectivity of the gear. So when you tow it over the sea floor, do you collect all 10? Like if there are 10 scallops in the path, do you collect all 10, or do you only collect 5, which would be 50% efficiency, or 2, which is 20% efficiency?
So why don't we know what the efficiency of this gear is?
Well, it's very hard to do. First thing is that the way to measure it is you have to put the gear down in the same path, exactly the same path, and keep towing until all the scallops are gone from the path, and the decline is your efficiency. The decline in that slope, it's just kind of a straight regression. But that's very hard to do. I mean, you have tide, and you have currents, to lay a dredge that's 80 fathoms below you and behind you, going at 3 knots is a hard thing to do in the exact same spot. So that causes error. And we actually tried to do those experiments, and there was a lot of variation in the estimate. And so I said to the dean, Brian Rothschild, I said, I think there's a better way based on kind of scuba diving techniques. And so what we came up with was a pyramid where you put it's a simple sampling pyramid where you put cameras on it, and it's just like counting dandelions in your backyard, where you take a hoop and you throw it out randomly, and then you count how many dandelions are in there. So the same principle. We decided that we would not accept the usual assumptions, that we kind of knew where the scallops were. We just talked to the fishermen, and they outlined their general fishing grounds, and then we did a grid pattern in there and came up with the right number so that we could have a high precision of estimate. And that is because we also wanted to determine the impacts of the fishery. We wanted to have estimates of the densities in there before they were fished and after they were fished, because people are very concerned about the effects of the fishing on the environment.
So you said that.
I'm sorry.
You said it was conversations with fishermen that made you think that there was more of a resource out there, and that you were working with the fishermen. Did they approach you to try to recruit you to do some research, or did you approach them and say, you know, I need some help getting my research started? How did that interaction begin?
Well, they actually approached the dean. They approached Brian Rothschild. Yeah, the story goes he was tying his boat up, his sailboat up, and they came in and asked him. It was Bobby Bruno and Marty Manley and Melvin Kavilhog. And so that's what started it. The industry asked for help. They, you know, I mean, it was pretty severe. They were facing a bankruptcy, and, you know, people were trying to fish as close to the edge or you know, they were desperate. And so they explained the situation to us, and, you know, people don't risk losing their boats and the kind of penalties out there there are unless they think there are a lot of scallops in those areas, and it certainly makes sense. I had done my PhD on scallops, and, you know, that it seemed pretty reasonable. So that's what we did. The first experiments were completely funded by the fishing industry. We just borrowed some gear and bought some televisions from Walmart, and the boat was donated. The time and the crew were donated. Chris Wright, Captain Chris Wright, took us out. He still goes out with us each year, and we went out and we did a pilot study and proved that we could do it, and that led to us developing it. But every year, I've been on the my students and I have done over 150 week-long surveys since 1999, and we've never paid for a vessel. The vessels are always donated. And the food and the fuel are usually donated as well, and the fisherman's time.
Well, the research is actually funded in large part by what are called revenue set-asides, correct? That the fishermen are actually essentially donating a portion of their profits to fund this research that affects their livelihood.
Right. They put up, like, for example, if you're allowed to harvest 20% of what's on the seafloor, they said, well, we'll take 18% and use the other 2% for to support research. So we and other institutes write proposals. We submit them to NOAA, and then they grant us pounds of scallops. And then, working with the fishing industry, we allocate those funds to either, you know, to go out and do our research, and the fishermen will go out and collect the scallops and pay the university a portion of that. So it's a balance between, you know, it's cooperation on their part, and I got to say the university contributes as well by reducing its indirect costs to let us do that.
Now, I think you said it was about 150 cruises that you've completed at this point. How much of the seafloor of New England have you actually taken pictures of at this point?
We've surveyed about 70,000 kilometers. Square. We surveyed from Virginia all the way to the Hague Line, which is 200 miles offshore, right on the Canadian-U.S. line. And we've done that whole, from 2003, the industry asked us to do the whole footprint of the survey. And so we've done that every year from 2003 until last year. We didn't have the funds this year to do it, unfortunately, but we're hoping for next year.
I mean, you're not talking about having a picture of literally every inch or every foot of that whole area, right? It's subsampling.
Well, yeah, that our basic survey is a 3 nautical mile grid. So we go to a spot there's a dot every 3 nautical miles, and if you think of it, it's just like a checkerboard or something. It's just on a grid, and we drop the pyramid down 4 times, and we get for those 4 times we survey about 13 meters squared, and we identify all the animals that we can see in that. There's about 50 different invertebrates in our database, and we also identify the sea floor. But then each year we shift the grid. So if you use it's kind of built on a mosaic pattern. If you see some of those, you know, Roman mosaics and stuff, and how you take a lot of little images and you put it together to make a big picture. That's the concept. And so we shift the stations halfway between each other each year and rotate them around, so that if you compile those 10 years, you actually get a very high resolution of the sea floor. And then some of my students have actually published these different high-resolution maps that are equivalent to side scan sonar and such.
But isn't
it's a very simple system?
Isn't the seafloor and the scallop resource and the ecosystem changing over the course of that 10 years?
Well, the scallop system resource is changing as far as you get. You know, we see a regular 20% recruitment or thereabouts a year, and then occasionally you get these huge pulse recruitments. It's kind of like a locus or something like that, where you'll just, you know, see the whole resource double in number. The other thing that about our survey is that we focus on counting individuals, not on biomass, and so it's much more of a biological study in that we follow the numbers and the populations. So that's one of the things that we've really noticed. The other one is that scallops aren't the most abundant invertebrate out there. It's really echinoderms, starfish, and sand dollars are an order of magnitude more abundant. But as far as shifts, as far as real changes based on, you know, something like climate warming or something like that, we haven't seen so much of that yet. But we're working with a number of different groups to try and look at that in various databases. And our data set is used by the Habitat Omnibus to help with the habitat impacts of the entire fishery in both the Mid-Atlantic and on Georges. And what we're moving into now is also using this as a beta database for looking at wind farm and wind farm developments offshore. So we're working with NOAA and with BOEM on that.
The numbers of photographs that you're talking about taking sounds really enormous. Are you literally, is someone sitting down in front of a computer with each of these photographs and doing the counting?
Yeah. We're a little old school on that one, because I know there's a lot of talk about different recognition programs and stuff. But for me, I've always been fascinated with looking at the seafloor, and I think it's also important for students to be able to learn and identify invertebrates and fish. And so we have a pretty rigorous training protocol, and every year as part of our grants we provide a student employment for a number of undergraduates and even some high school students, and we train five or six of them every year. And we have a whole database. These videos, we take the videos, and when you go to sea, we count them at sea, and then we come back and we replay them, and we identify all the different 50 invertebrates, and we actually mark the major ones for the target fisheries. We save those markings because our work has been called into federal court and has to stand up there. And so we have a complete database. So I could, you know, if you wanted to see what was at this location in 2003 and why we counted five scallops there instead of nine, I could call you up the image, show you the counts, and then we could look at the original video data and see it. So it's a real history of the sea floor.
Out of curiosity, why has your data been called into federal courts?
They were called in when the Marine Fisheries Service first opened the three closed areas, Nantucket Lightship Area, Closed Area 1, and Closed Area 2 for harvest, they were sued by some environmental groups. And so our work went in as, you'll pardon me if I forget the term, it's a friendly something or another, but we went in as a support, basically a support, and showed them the maps, the surveys that we were doing, and blew up images of the seafloor and explained the cooperative nature. And the judge found for the Marine Fisheries Service, and also because the industry was so proactive in supporting this research, and that we were collecting the data not only to show how much the resource was, but also the impacts of the fishery.
I mean, you can imagine you're gathering data that says there are more scallops out there. We could be fishing more. This is obviously a message that the scallopers are going to want to get across. I wonder how your research was received, though, by the National Marine Fisheries Service, what it took to prove the technology and actually get it adopted by the Fisheries Service.
It took about 10 years of debate. it took a lot, and it's still not, you know, it's still a bit of a contention there, actually. But And I do want to correct something on there. It's very true. When we first did it, we found way more scallops. The first time we surveyed the resource, we found twice as many scallops as people thought were out there. So it doubled the resource, which is the resource is $2.5 billion worth of stock. It's a huge resource. But then in recent years, we found less of the Marine Fisheries Service. When the elephant trunk area was open, it was scheduled to have something like 9 trips, and they were going to reduce it to 5. And we had a meeting with the fishing industry, and we said, you know, we think there are only 3 trips here. And they voluntarily and pushed the council to reduce it to 3 trips based on our data. So they've listened to us when we said there's more, but the industry also has listened to us when we said there's less. And last year we saw a big recruitment in the elephant trunk area. We advised they close it immediately. And the Marine Fisheries Service also saw the same thing. And so the industry and the Marine Fisheries Service and us, we all together, they put through an emergency action which closed that area. So I think it, you know, to be fair, you know, the industry has really bought into this, and part of it is because it's so simple. They go out with us, they see, they count the scallops as well when the images are on the seafloor, when the pyramid's on the seafloor.
So
they do that. I'm sorry, I might not have answered your question completely there.
Yeah, no, I how much of the rebound or the rebuilding of the scallop fishery has been an actual increase in the number of scallops out there, and how much of it has been a rebound in the industry and the fishery because we now have a better understanding of what the resource actually is?
Well, I think originally it was an increase in the numbers. One of the things that really rebuilt it was we had a huge recruitment in 2003, which we videotaped and presented to the council. We recommended they close. That was the beginning of the elephant trunk area in the Mid-Atlantic. It took them about a year to close it, which was unfortunate because I think they did lose a fair bit of stock. But there was the resource now has about 8 billion animals in it, 8 billion, 4 billion on Georges Bank, 4 billion in the Mid-Atlantic. And when a year or two ago it started to decrease, you know, and that what decreased it was that huge pulse of scallops was starting to be fished down. But then in 2012, we had another good recruitment, and so they closed the area and protected it again. So I think that what rebuilds these populations is basically being able to observe and take advantage of these huge recruitments, these anomalous recruitments. You've seen the same thing in the haddock populations. There's 2 recruitment year classes of haddock out there, which are larger than we've ever seen. The same with the scallops. I wouldn't be surprised if that's similar with what's going on with lobsters. And so what you need are the scientific tools to be able to identify those recruitments, identify where they're happening, how many they are, and protect them quickly.
That
requires both the scientific technology and the management, the bureaucratic agility to do it, I guess.
You testified before Congress earlier this spring, and during your testimony said that it was incredibly important to avoid preconceived notions. We've got a little less than a minute here. Why is it so important to avoid preconceived notions in fishery research?
Well, because, we don't know nearly as much as we think we do, and B, things are changing. And so if you're always assuming it's the way it was, you're going to miss it. And with fisheries, you've got to be quick. You know, that's the main thing. You've got to, in my opinion, using old techniques aren't going to do it. You've got to look at absolute numbers, so how many animals per unit squared, and we should have the technology to be able to do that in both invertebrates and fish now.
Kevin Stokesbury, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Kevin Stokesbury is chair of the Department of Fisheries Oceanography at the School for Marine Science and Technology at UMass Dartmouth. This is Living Lab on the Point. You can find Living Lab Radio all week on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.